From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the sequester, the $85 billion in spending cuts that Congress and President Obama delayed at the start of the year, is set to take effect on March 1st, and the cuts are split between defense and domestic programs and will slice into Medicare, work assistance, police departments, and many other government programs. We'll talk to experts about the sequester's effects, both nationally and here in California. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Sequestration has become a far more recognizable word than any of us might have ever imagined, a result of the so-called Super Committee, the Joint Committee on Deficit Reduction, and its inability to reach a solution last year to cut government spending. Sequestration could mean $85 billion in automatic federal spending cuts set to go into effect at the end of this week unless Congress acts. This hour is all about the likely or anticipated effects of sequestration nationally as well as here in California. And joining us for the hour from Washington, D.C. is David Leonhardt. He is Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and author of a book called Here's the Deal, How Washington Can Solve the Deficit and Spur Growth. And we welcome you, David Leonhardt.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Stephen Levy, no stranger to Forum listeners, Director of the Center for Continuing Study, the California Economy. Welcome, Steve Levy.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And David Leonhardt, let me begin, if I may, with you. As I said earlier on, the defense and domestic programs are evenly divided as far as these cuts, including health care on the domestic side. They're across-the-board cuts. But who's going to be hurt most by this?
Well, you can look at it any number of different ways. There have been some analyses looking at which states are going to be hurt most, and it's a mixture of states in the Midwest and in the South, which is not that surprising because states on the coast tend to be a little bit less reliant on the federal government than states in the middle of the country and in the South. You could look at specific areas. It's clear that defense is going to take a bigger cut than it has recently. Some of the recent cuts have spared defense almost completely. These clearly do not. They hit defense. And the economy is going to be hurt because while this isn't in all likelihood going to cause a recession all on its own, it is going to hurt the economy. And we have now, when you combine this with the state and local cuts, we've actually seen a lot of government pullback, what economists call austerity, from governments in the last few years.
Well, you know, if you read what's coming out of each political party's press releases and the like, you read the Republicans saying that this is over-exaggerated in terms of the hurt that it will cause or the impact, that it's really in the long run kind of small. And the Democrats, of course, saying it's going to hurt terribly. It seems as if it's all about politics again. And I know you've taken the position that the Democrats have won the debate on benefits and the Republicans on taxes. So we're once again really kind of at strong loggerheads here, aren't we?
That's right. And so, I mean, I think that this notion, and this is what I talk about in the e-book, this notion that the deficit comes in part from public opinion, which is that we want relatively large benefits and relatively low taxes, because who wouldn't, is a force behind a lot of this. You see it here. So what is spared in all of this? Well, Social Security and Medicare are spared. Taxes, in a way, are spared. Taxes aren't going to go up. And so if you look at the cuts that have already happened in the last few years, they have been focused overwhelmingly, if not exclusively, on the parts of the government outside of Medicare and Social Security. Medicare and Social Security are really popular. Over the long term, Medicare is really the source, above all, of our deficit. And yet we're now cutting the deficit not by going after the program that causes the long-term problems, but going after everything else, these so-called discretionary programs, which are not most of the budget. You could actually think of the federal budget as four pieces that are roughly similar in size. Piece one is defense, piece two is Medicare, piece three is Social Security, and piece four is everything else. And these cuts have been overwhelmingly toward that fourth piece, the everything else, and now we're going to add defense to that, but still not Medicare or Social Security.
So you're saying that sequester, if it goes into effect on March 1st, will really have quite an effect on economic growth?
It certainly could. I mean, the best guess of economists, and let's be honest here, economists do not exactly have a perfect forecasting record. The best guess of economists is on the order of a half a percentage point of economic growth this year, certainly enough to keep unemployment higher than it would otherwise be, but probably not enough, barring something unexpected, to take us from a growing economy to a recession.
We're talking, by the way, with David Leonhardt, Washington, D.C. bureau chief for the New York Times, author of Here's the Deal, How Washington Can Solve the Deficit and Spur Growth. Suddenly, a lot of talk has been centering around air traffic control and all of the furloughs in terms of loss of jobs.
That's right, because I think that's one of the areas where we could see it. You could see longer delays at the airport, and that's obviously something that becomes very tangible. And you could even imagine it affecting the politics. At this point, no one expects a deal before March 1. I think a lot of us would be shocked to have a deal before March 1, because what's happened is the Democrats have said, we are not willing to do any deal that is in a mix of spending cuts and tax increases. And the Republicans have said, we're not willing to do any more tax increases. The Republicans are focusing on the last deficit reduction, which came at the very end of the year, which was all tax increases. The Democrats are focusing on the combined last 2 years of deficit reduction, which has been more spending cuts than tax increases. And so no one sees a deal. But now let's imagine that lines at the airport are in fact horrible. I don't think we know whether they will be or not, but let's imagine that they are. Or let's imagine something flares up in the Middle East and the country decides that it really needs the second aircraft carrier there, which it has delayed from sending. Then you could imagine the politics changing and maybe something like air traffic actually being a spur to a later deal on this. A lot of these cuts don't take effect immediately, so there'll be a few weeks in which officially they've gone into effect, but most of them actually have not.
Because the Republicans are hypersensitive now to having lost ground among Hispanics and with many interest groups, actually. And according to Pew Research, more citizens will be blaming the GOP than they will the Democrats.
That's right. Polls have consistently found that the public believes that Obama and the Democrats have been more willing to compromise than Republicans have. I mean, I think looking at the facts here, I think that's objectively true. Now, that doesn't mean that compromise is better. Sometimes sticking to your principles is better. But if you look at the Democrats at this point are open to a solution that would be a mix of tax increases, changes to Social Security, changes to Medicare, and cuts to the other programs. And Republicans have said that they don't want tax increases to be any part of that. Now, in the long term, I'm not sure whether the Republicans can stick to that position, because we have a long-term deficit program, and the idea of saying that all of the solution is going to come from spending, when Republicans themselves aren't that interested in getting too specific about the kind of Medicare and Social Security cuts they favor, I think may not be tenable. But I think it probably is tenable in the short term here.
Well, let's talk with Stephen Levy about the long term and the short term. Stephen Levy, again, is director of the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy. In terms of the California economy, Stephen, what do you envisage?
David did just a wonderful explanation. Let me see if I can not duplicate too much. In the short term, these are small cuts relative to the economy. That's not to say there won't be some inconvenience for people at airports, for example. But at most, California could lose $10 billion in federal funding, and we have a $2,000 billion economy. So as David said, it would slow economic growth in 2013, but not cause a recession. So small is the operative word. And yeah, everybody's exaggerating the impacts, in part because the cuts don't take effect all at once, and more particularly because there will be a new budget for the fiscal year starting in October developed in the next month or two, and all of this will be subsumed into that. So small is an operative word. Stupid is the other operative word. It's primarily for the reason that David said, which is that the cuts currently proposed in the sequester don't address any, except for defense, of the major items in the budget, and don't address the major cost-escalating item, which is health care costs for Medicaid and Medicare, okay? The damage to California in the short term will be roughly the same as in the nation. We're no longer a heavily defense-oriented state, say, compared to Virginia. So we will participate in the cuts It might shave 75,000 jobs off of an expected gain of 250,000, depending on how long it goes on. But the real stupidity of this is about the long term. There have to be cuts, but there used to be a bipartisan consensus, really important for California, that we should be investing in education from preschool through the university, so we're going to lose some research dollars. There used to be a consensus about investing in research and development. The National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, all of the work around clean energy, around developing a new battery. Those investments for the future are all in what David said correctly are the discretionary programs, which are now the focus of the cuts. So in addition to not solving the problem, the current pattern of sequestration will really especially harm the research and investment agenda that's trying to be important for California. The other important point that David touched on is that the $85 billion is the first year of perhaps $1.5 trillion that we're going to have to do. Maybe $2 trillion would be better in my mind over the next decade. So it's small in relation to the current economy, but it's small in relation to the deficit reduction package that we're going to have to hash out. It's just not very good policy, but it's not going to destroy everybody's lives.
Well, you know, I'm looking at numbers, Stephen, that were sent out by the White House of how California could be affected by these automatic budget cuts if they take effect next week, this week, excuse me. And that's according to the White House. And you go down the list, and it looks, frankly, kind of bleak. Work-study jobs, around 9,600 fewer low-income students in California could receive aid to help them finance costs of college, and around 33,690 fewer students would get work-study jobs. It's going to affect Head Start, eliminating about 8,200 children from Head Start, law enforcement and public safety funds, public health. California could lose $2.6 million in funds, nutrition for seniors. In other words, this is going to have pretty pervasive effect, even though it's, in the grand scheme of things, in the big numbers, kind of small.
It's going to have very targeted effect on the few programs that are subject to the cuts. Actually, if you add up the numbers released by the White House, they don't come anywhere near to the $10 billion that I used as an estimate of our share of the $85 billion. They come far, far below that. This is a $2,000 billion economy. So you are talking about targeted cuts to people that I wouldn't have chosen. But that begs the question that David started out with, which is we all agree we have to make cuts, and we're in deep division about where they should be. I could craft another set that would protect Head Start and protect children for public health nutrition, but might target oil subsidies or ethanol subsidies or ask Medicare beneficiaries like myself to pay a higher share of the cost. But we're in division about that. So let's not lose sight of the fact that there is broad agreement that over the next 10 years we need to reduce the deficit by $1.5 trillion, which, again, is not that large a number. It's $150 billion a year for 10 years, and it could be fairly easily done, except, as David said, we like our benefits, and we don't want to pay anymore, and we are, as a country, stuck.
Stephen Levy, with us by phone this morning, directs the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy. I bring out a number of other people to talk about the effects of these cuts, potentially. Lenore Anderson directs the Californians for Safety and Justice, and she recently returned from a visit to the White House, where she discussed public safety concerns with officials. And welcome, Lenore Anderson. Good to have you on Forum.
Thank you.
That meeting that you had with public safety people, what came out of it?
Well, the picture that was painted about the impact of these cuts on public safety was absolutely bleak. You know, federal funding is an incredibly important source of innovation, as well as support for evidence-based practices and strategies that help local jurisdictions reduce crime safely and effectively. And so when you talk about eliminating that federal funding or significantly reducing it, it definitely has a direct impact on California communities.
And particularly talking about police departments, staff, community policing, those kinds of things?
Yeah, we talked a lot about the fact that there's definitely going to have to be police layoffs as a result. Many police departments in California, from Fresno to Long Beach, Oakland, Sacramento, these are police departments that have already experienced significant police layoffs before the sequester potential. And, you know, federal funding not only supports specific police positions, but it really supports proactive policing, community policing, data-driven policing, policing strategies that local budgets oftentimes can't afford to do. And so when you take that away, you're talking about going from not just, you know, fewer police, but a different strategy. You're going to go from proactive policing down to, you know, what we call reactive policing, which is by most measures less effective.
Well, realignment has already taken a toll. This would just exacerbate, no?
Yeah, you know, the devastating reality of cuts on top of cuts, you know, means that local jurisdictions, which are right now being asked to do more and play more of a leadership role in public safety, are strapped even more than they were. You know, public safety realignment in California, this is the state policy that switched responsibility for managing certain categories of people convicted of felonies from state prisons to local jurisdictions. The move from prior practices to realignment was really a move that said, look, local jurisdictions are going to be able to reduce crime more effectively through things like community corrections, things like smart justice strategies that emphasize drug treatment and local programs. But a lot of that came out of innovation from federal funding. You know, when I talk to county leaders across the state and you ask them, how did you get that innovative program that reduces recidivism and that helps victims, they'll often say a federal grant or federal dollars that really allowed that innovation to begin. And so it's really important when we're at a crossroads, when we're transitioning from, you know, our prior approach to criminal justice and public safety, which probably relied too heavily on state prisons and bloated state prison bureaucracies. When you switch and you say, look, let's do this smarter, let's do it better, let's focus local, we really need to provide the kind of support that locals need to do that right.
So bottom line, it's grim.
Yeah, I'd say that, you know, we're going to see fewer victims being able to recover, hard-to-reach victims. Oftentimes those are federal dollars that reach out to those victims. And then the cycle of crime, you know, reducing recidivism and emphasis on data and other strategies that are really smart justice approaches, those are going to take a hit as well.
Lenore Anderson directs the Californians for Safety and Justice, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, she recently returned from a visit to the White House, and there's a link to the White House list of California cuts that you can find on our website. I want to bring Gary Folley into this conversation. Gary Folley is Associate Vice President for Federal Governmental Relations at the University of California. He joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome, Gary Folley.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about UC. I mean, in terms of it's being an educational and research enterprise, what are we talking about vis-a-vis these effects?
I mean, they can be devastating impact on higher education as a whole and on the University of California. These are going to be painful reductions in both student aid and in research. Michael, you already mentioned that the administration came out with some estimates for California, and on the student aid and financial aid area, there's going to be like 13,000 students that will be affected, $11 million. And this is not counting the Pell Grant program that is exempt from the sequester cuts this year, but will definitely be in the mix next year if sequester continues. So in financial aid and student aid, it's going to be very significant impact. On research, as Stephen has already mentioned, the long-term effects on research can also be devastating. I mean, we know already that NIH, National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, and others are already making fewer awards, and those are going to end up costing jobs of scientists, researchers, students, and et cetera, and in the long term on the California economy. We've already started seeing those kind of impacts. We know that the National Institute of Health has been holding back. I think they said they're holding back 10% of funding that in anticipation of these sequestration cuts. And in looking at the latest available data that we have at the University of California, we've already seen those kind of reductions happening, almost a 22% drop in federal funds over the same period of a previous years. And that's significant. The last point is really, really also important, and that is the uncertainty that all this brings. I mean, we're creating a huge uncertainty for students and families planning for college for next year and not knowing what's going to happen with these kind of student aid programs, especially in 2014 and beyond when Pell Grants are brought back into the mix. University of California, 40% of our students are Pell Grant recipients, and there's going to be a very strong squeeze on those on that funding for next year.
I'm just wondering, Stephen Levy, the picture you painted was not nearly as bleak as what we're hearing from Gary Fowley, so I'd like to hear what you have to say, and from Lenore, too.
I think that first of all, everybody that's going to come on your program is speaking the truth from their perspective. These are all services that have been under fiscal pressure for several years. And so any cuts, large or small, are going to seem painful. I don't know whether I go with the word devastating. I was trying to make a distinction, as David was, between the impact on the macro economy, which is a slowing of growth, not devastating or not a recession, and the particular stupidity, at least in my mind, of the way the current batch of cuts is targeted. I can't defend the current batch of cuts and that they may have impact on the individuals in these programs. But remember, as David said, there are many, many programs and many, many, many millions of Californians who are going to be unaffected by these cuts, whereas they probably should be. So these are small, targeted cuts that will absolutely hurt the people involved, but they're not large in the macro economy. And
I understand that distinction, Stephen, but when you think about all the tuition costs that have gone up and all the cuts that have taken place, particularly at the university level here in California, it's going to be probably a very rocky ride. I want to actually extend an invitation now to you, our listeners, and my thanks, first of all, to Gary Fowley for joining us, Associate Vice President for Governmental Relations at UC, who joined us from Washington. We're going to also bring Frank Gaffney into this discussion, who will talk about the result of possible results of sequestration cuts on defense here in the United States and, again, on California. But let me invite you to join us with any questions or comments you might have. We'll continue with David Leonhardt and Stephen Levy and with you if you would like to join the program. Our toll-free number is available, and we welcome your calls. It's 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, please feel free to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, and you can join us now. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments immediately onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, but please feel free to join us, and we'll continue talking about sequestration on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The sequester, the $85 billion in spending cuts that Congress and President Obama delayed at the start of the year, is set to take effect the end of this week on March the 1st. The cuts are split between defense and domestic programs and will slice into Medicare, work assistance, police departments, and many other government programs. And we're talking to experts about the sequester's effects both nationally and here in California. David Leonhardt is with us from Washington. He is Washington, D.C. bureau chief for The New York Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and author of Here's the Deal, How Washington Can Solve the Deficit and Spur Growth. We also have Stephen Levy with us for the hour, director of the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy We've had a couple of call-outs. We spoke earlier with, before we went to this break, with Lenore Anderson, who directs Californians for Safety and Justice, and with Gary Fowley, who is Associate Vice President of Federal Governmental Relations for the University of California. We want to bring Frank Gaffney into this discussion, too. He's President and CEO of the Center for Security Policy. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy in the Reagan administration. And welcome back to Forum, Frank Gaffney. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Well, let's begin by talking with you before we go to our callers and find out what they want to know and what they have to say about the sequestration, the effect of sequestration. What are we talking about in terms of defense? Heard a lot of rhetoric about this is going to make us a lesser power, a second-rate power, all of that sort of thing. Is that realistic?
Unfortunately, it is. And that's principally because defense is being charged half of the sequestration cuts, even though defense-related expenditures by the federal government only constitute about 20% of the overall government outlays. And when you think about this not simply as a disproportionate cut in defense expenditures, but that it comes on top of about $800 billion that have already been taken out or in the process of being taken out as a result of previous decisions by the Obama administration, by the Congress, the impact is going to be staggering. And we've been told that, not just by people like myself outside of government or people who are, in one of the political parties who may have a position, you know, that justifies that warning. But we're talking about the Secretary of Defense under President Obama and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, every single one of them, who have used terms like catastrophic and hollow force. And I think that's not an exaggeration. I don't think they're playing budget games. I think they're warning about a real and possibly irreversible impact on the ability of this country to provide for its security over the long haul.
What about the data, though, that keeps coming up in this context, Frank Gaffney? I mean, we're still spending more, for example, than the next 14 countries, most of them allies, in the world, and we've had the smallest post-war reductions in half a century.
Well, I would quibble with some of those findings. I think we really don't have a clue what the Chinese are spending on their defense, but it's likely at the rates of growth that they're engaging in, and you add in the secret budgets, to be considerably higher than most of those 14 combined. But let me just address the point straight on. I think that what we deal with in this country is a set of responsibilities and interests that are global in character. And while we are not the world's policemen exactly, we have an interest in stability and order around the world, and nobody for a moment would say that the police have to be spending approximately the same amount as criminals are in order to provide for the public safety. That's, I think, crazy, and I think most people understand that we need to take the additional costs now to provide for the common defense, or we will wind up paying much, much more. And that's the thing that pains me most about this, is history tells us, if it tells us anything, that whatever penny-wise, and I don't even think this is penny-wise the way we're doing this sequestration, but it's whatever penny-wise steps you're taking now will prove to be pound foolish if they result in aggression against our interests, and that leads to war.
And I wonder how you respond to essentially, the sort of argument that the Republicans are claiming and have claimed consistently that government spending can't create jobs. But those in the Defense Department who are talking like you about the catastrophic effects of these cuts are saying we're going to lose jobs and too many furloughs, and the job loss fear should be paramount.
Well, I think that what should be paramount is the national security, but I'd be crazy not to recognize that there are economic impacts if you take these kinds of MEDEX cuts. And we've done a set of studies called the Defense Economic Breakdown Report, and you can find it at forthecommondefense.org. And just to give you some sense of the magnitude of this, in the public sector, we're looking at something on the order of 181,000 military jobs and 177,000 civilian jobs. On top of that, you'd have private sector losses of about million. So that's about 1.3 million jobs. And I don't think this economy is going to do very well taking that kind of hit. And there are comparable costs in terms of dollar amounts. $50 to $62 billion per year are estimated to be coming out of the economy as a result of these cuts. That will have an effect on our economy that greatly compounds. It doesn't supplant, but it greatly compounds, I think, the predictable and very undesirable effects on the national security.
Frank Gaffney, again, is president and CEO of the Center for Security Policy and was formerly Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy in the Ronald Reagan administration. We thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you.
And let me go to your calls and emails here in just a moment. But David Leonhardt, let's hear from you.
Well, I think it's certainly true that the military has played an outsized role in fostering innovation in this country. The Defense Department literally built the internet, the jet engine, radar, all kinds of things. Many of the innovations that were central to the post-war boom came out of World War II. And for a whole variety of reasons, the military not only can fund research that the private sector wouldn't find profitable, but the military can become a really important early client so that even before something's commercially viable, it can kind of get off the ground. Aviation is not a bad example. And I think that's certainly true. That all that kind of spending, though, represents a tiny fraction of the military budget. And so I think it's possible that you could actually make a pretty substantial cut to our military spending, which, as you noted in your question, has risen really rapidly in a very short period of time, and we now spend more than the rest of the world combined does on military, and possibly not damage economic growth. And that's really the key here. You don't want to damage economic growth because nothing reduces the deficit and lifts living standards better than economic growth. Unfortunately, the sequester that we have, it takes an across-the-board whack. And so it's not only going to hit some areas where there's almost certainly waste in the Pentagon, but it's going to hit some of these research areas that could actually be planting the seeds for future economic growth.
I'm going to go to our callers now, though. David, before we end this program, I'd like to get your take on some areas we haven't been able to bring into the discussion here, particularly in terms of medical public health, and if we can get to it, and I hope we can. Also, talk somewhat about what's going to be the effect on national parks. But let me get our callers in here. We begin with Brandon. Good morning.
Hi, you guys. Good morning. So I would like to know ask your experts, given that so much of our current economic recovery is being fueled by the housing recovery, are you concerned at all that the Fed is basically keeping those interest rates really low through QE, as everybody knows, just blatant money printing? That's a temporary strategy at best, at the cost of really inflation, the value of our currency. If this whole cut equation, everybody's freaking out over an $85 billion cut, which is 0.5% of a $16 trillion economy. If the housing movement cut is more than half of the whole current GDP, which is, say, is 2 to 3%, and that comes to an end, I would think everybody's got to see that that's going to pose a much greater threat than this current sequester, and that has got to be ending, I would think, within the next year. What do you guys think?
Yeah, what do you think about the housing market and its role in all this? Let's talk about in California, Stephen Levy.
The housing market going forward is a key component of growth. Most of the jobs lost in California, and the reason we did worse in the recession was that we went from building 200,000 homes to 40,000. We lost 600,000 jobs. So the housing recovery is very important. In general, the rate of economic growth in the country is the most important determinant of how fast we reduce the deficit. But there's one point that I'd like to make, that however sincere, and they are, your callers are saying, not me, not my program is too important, doesn't solve the problem. And so we ought to be discussing whether we think we shouldn't have any deficit reduction, but if we do, then the important thing is to reach an agreement on solving the problem. And saying not me without saying what else doesn't solve the problem. It reflects the dilemma that David said at the beginning of the program is that no one wants to give up what's important to them. By the way, I bet David and I could solve this thing in 3 minutes and agree on 98% of the stuff.
Well, actually, if you read David's book, you can learn a lot of the solutions. We ought to do a separate program with you, David, because there's a lot of rich material in there that really leads to some light, and we can learn a great deal from the book, again, which is Here's the Deal. But
thank you.
I also get to respond to an email here, David, a listener from Santa Cruz says, how can a single-digit reduction cause so much harm when it would take a 35% cut to get back to the Clinton era of spending? Is anyone analyzing the cuts for Washington Monument Syndrome, in other words, cutting the most visible things first?
Well, so is that referring specifically to defense?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an important point, that defense spending has come way, way, way up since 2001. And obviously, a lot of that initially had to do with the Afghanistan war and the hunt for al-Qaeda and the Iraq war, whatever you think of those wars. Clearly, a lot of the spending came from that. And now those wars are winding down, and the hunt for al-Qaeda is not over, but it does not take up a huge portion of the budget. And so it's interesting. There was a group called the Sustainable Defense Task Force that was appointed by Barney Frank. It was a bipartisan group, and it identified about $100 billion a year in defense cuts that it thought could be made without any harm to the national defense whatsoever. And with this sequester, we're actually, and the earlier defense cuts that Frank Gaffney mentioned, we're going to get actually pretty close to that level that the group called for. I think part of the problem here is that the cuts aren't being done in the most intelligent way. But is it possible to run a military that keeps the country safe and operates well at a level that the sequester would put it at? I think that's a question that you can make a very reasonable argument that the answer is yes, even if, of course, in defense, just as in healthcare, just as in every other realm, anyone who would be affected by the cut is going to claim that it would do grievous damage to the country and the economy.
Well, since you mentioned the Barney Frank Group's proposed cuts, there's been a lot of talk about bringing back the deficit reduction plan of Bowles and Simpson. How did that look at defense cuts?
Bowles and Simpson also called for pretty substantial cuts to defense. And that's one of the things about Bowles Simpson. Everyone talks about Bowles Simpson, or many people talk about Bowles Simpson as this great, sensible solution. Well, you can like Bowles Simpson or you can't, but it's important to keep in mind Bowles Simpson involves a very large tax increase. It involves a substantial cut to the military. It involves a substantial and undefined cut to future Medicare growth. It involves potential changes to all kinds of areas. And so if you're going to say that you want to solve the deficit, and I'm echoing others here, really what you should do is you should say what combination of tax increases and spending cuts you favor. Bowles Simpson has a lot of tax increases and spending cuts in it.
Let me read just a couple of emails from listeners. Janet says, I'm a public servant in state government. I've been subject to furloughs one day a month, which means a 5% reduction in pay for at least 3 years. I think the members of Congress and their staff should be the first to furlough and share in the pain because of the horrible gridlock in Washington that they have caused. Another listener, and there are several like this, Art writes, in this and other discussions on the topic, why do we hear so little about the pitfalls of austerity? Aside from Paul Krugman and Robert Reich, we don't hear how little economic sense it makes to cut back on spending. Austerity has negatively impacted European nations, and that policy dominates economic discussions in the U.S. despite the fact that it doesn't work. We should be stimulating the budget and creating jobs instead. Let me bring some more of your calls on. And Ivan, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, sir. You're on the air, please.
Hi. I had a question in the vein of that last comment. In fact, how come that the what we would call the Krugman solution, that just canceling the sequester altogether, since right now the federal government can borrow essentially negative interest rates for the next 5 or 10 years, how come just canceling the sequester altogether, at least for these years, seems to be completely off the table?
Yeah, it is off the table. Why, David Leonhardt? Do you see it off the table?
I think the Republicans would not allow it. I think House Republicans don't, shall we say, buy into the Krugman solution. And so there's no scenario in which Republican leadership in Washington would accept simply canceling the sequester.
Which may be one of the reasons for the Pew Research conclusions. And let me thank Ivan for his call and go right to another caller. That's you, Bob. You're on. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
These cuts would be disastrous for the economy. The only example I can offer is if you're flying an airplane and you run out of gas, you got a really expensive problem on your hands. And I really resent anybody that marginalizes the innovation and the productivity of the United States. We are, and I've communicated with Washington about these issues, that we are eliminating our trade deficit, and we need to come up with a long-term plan, not a short-term, a long-term plan to reduce our deficit.
All right. I thank you for that. And let me go to some web comments. Bob says, $85 billion out of annual spending of what, $2 to $3 trillion these days? That's less than a 5% cut at worst. And how much of this cut is actually a decrease in the planned increase that was desired? This whole sequester thing is a tempest in a teapot. The Pentagon by itself could trivially absorb the cut by dropping the hugely wasteful F-35 program and the strategic bombers, a hangover from the Cold War. And Wilbur says, on NPR the other day, they had Bill Moyers interviewing Richard Wolff, who revealed that not only did U.S. taxpayers bail out the big banks and get shafted as far as foreclosures and increased lending goes, but it turns out the banks also shifted the bailout funds offshore so they didn't have to pay taxes on them. Meanwhile, we the taxpayers have to endure austerity due to their mostly unprosecuted criminal activities. The system is broken, our country is broke, and austerity will not mix anything. The problem, by the way, with some of this money offshore is that it's done, unfortunately, legally because of legal loopholes. Lou says, I'd like to hear the panel address this thought, that this is all grandstanding, boondoggle, to make the parties look as stupid as they have been acting. When will they get a government that governs instead of bickering like three-year-old children? Well, we talked earlier with you, David Leonhard, about how much political wrangling is and this gridlock is involved because of political or the result of political wrangling. Any thoughts about how we can come to some kind of common ground here, or is that even impossible?
Well, I don't think it's impossible. I don't think politicians are going to disappear and suddenly come out with a grand solution one day and everything will be fixed. But I don't think it's out of the question that they'll make fewer mistakes than they get things right and will be okay in the end. I'm not saying that's guaranteed to happen, but it's not out of the question either. I think that the two things I would focus on here are, one, while we do have a long-term deficit, and it is serious, it's something that we can solve without damaging the programs that lead to economic growth. This sequester doesn't do that. It goes after many of the programs that lead to long-term economic growth. And that then leads into the second point, which is this isn't about the politicians. It's also about we, the voters. And Stephen made this point very well. It isn't enough just to say, why won't politicians solve the deficit? We need a public that is actually going to reward politicians that want to solve the deficit. And solving the deficit isn't simply about canceling foreign aid or about punishing big banks. It's about some combination of tax increases and cuts to Medicare and to some extent Social Security and the military. And so I think one of the important things to think about is what combination of that do we as voters favor? And when we're clear about that, I think it'll be easier for the politicians to try to solve this problem as well.
Richard writes, if you devote funds to high salaries and pensions for public servants or make other spending decisions that feel good but consume funds, then you run out of money. The sequester may be the only way to wake up the public and the politicians and the government bureaucrats. Everyone had a year and a half to address the issue and refused to do so. We're going to get another caller in here, and that's you, Bob. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, you know, you talked the Simpson Bowles had huge spending cuts and tax increases to get the balanced budget. That's not how you get the balanced budget. You get the balanced budget from a great economy. And I'm wondering if there's been any analysis, there's been of protecting tax cuts versus how much loss in income the wealthy and wealthy corporations are going to be seeing in the next years to come from these across-the-board sequester. And also, when are we going to see Congressional Budget Office estimates as to what mix of spending cuts and tax increases would benefit the economy versus the across-the-board sequester? I mean, that's the Congressional Budget Office seems to be able to come across and show what can happen given tax increases and given showing what will be the benefit to the wealthy and the economy and the corporations versus the puny tax breaks that they get. I mean, it seems, you know, it's lopsidedly bad for the wealthy. And supposedly the Republicans are being shown to be the protectors of the economy, protectors of the wealthy. I don't think they are at all. And I'm wondering when we're going to see congressional budget office estimates of what this thing will do to the wealthy.
Some thoughts, David Leonard?
I think that the first point, which is that the way to solve the deficit is through economic growth, is right on. And think back to the late 1940s, 1950s. We emerged from World War II with a larger deficit as a share of our economy than any we've had recently. And we worked it off in relatively painless fashion. We didn't do it by establishing a Bull-Simpson Commission of the 1950s. We did it through rapid economic growth. Now, you can't just say, given the scale of our long-term deficit problems now and baby boomers and high health costs, you can't just say, well, we'll get rid of it through economic growth. You have to have some sort of strategy to try to get rid of it through economic growth. But it's really important to remember that the only ways to reduce the deficit are not tax increases or spending cuts, and that when you're putting in place tax increases and spending cuts to reduce the deficit, you want to do it with an eye toward making sure you keep economic growth as fast as possible, because historically that is the single best solution for deficit reduction.
Now I'm looking at an email here from a listener in Rockledge, Florida, named Chris, who says, why do we not hear how low taxes are now compared with any other era? In 1942, FDR requested 100% tax above $25,000, but settled for 94%. They were still above 50% in the 1950s. Some of our larger corporations pay nothing yet gain a lot of their profits here. And Stephen Levy, in fact, as long as we're looking back historically, one of our listeners, Craig, brings up Graham Rudman. That was a sequester back in the 80s. Have we learned much from that?
We know, in answer to the hasn't CBO done an analysis, we know that certain investments are really important for economic growth that the federal government does. We know that investing in infrastructure and in research and development and in innovative health care, and particularly in ways to reduce our energy use. We know that an investment in people and infrastructure, part of the federal budget, is hugely important to economic growth. As David said, we ought to be able to do that, but we have to come to an agreement about shrinking a lot of the benefit programs, shrinking the growth, by the way, not shrinking, for Medicare, Medicaid, which are health care costs, but we also spend a little bit more than we can sustain on Social Security. We have to have an agreement on where to make the cuts in growth so that we can do those investments that are really important for economic growth. I'll stick with stupid in terms of the particular mix of the sequester, but the idea of reducing the federal deficit over 10 years with a mixture of closing loopholes and cuts is not stupid. It's very important for economic growth, but so are the investments.
Stephen, let me go to the effect here in California, as you see it, on healthcare, because we talked to a representative from the California Medical Association, and what he told us in effect was, and I'm just talking about California now, but I think this can apply probably across the board. What he said was it's going to hurt implementation of programs that advance public health, but also prevention programs, safety programs. In other words, in fact, there was a letter signed by just about every professional medical organization and association saying that this will lead overall, and I'm talking nationally now, to more uncertainty about health care and outpatient access to care. And, I mean, do you see this, at least in your crystal ball, Steve Levy, as being significant to California?
I think it's true. I can't judge significance. But the most significant thing for California in terms of health care is effective implementation of the Affordable Care Act, getting the exchanges up, getting a lot of uninsured people covered, and reforming medical practice to bring down health care costs. So the cuts that are in the sequester are probably not helpful at all, but they're very small on the health future context relative to implementation of the Affordable Health Care Act and the exchanges, which could make, hopefully, a major difference in how health care is provided and how broadly it's provided in California. That's the major focus of where we should be looking.
All right, and I've got a number of emails like this, one from Bill in Berkeley, who says, Frank Gaffney is being disingenuous when he states unchallenged that military spending is 20% of federal spending. Military spending is 56% of discretionary spending, which is the only part of the budget subject to the sequester. So its cut is in line with its expenditures. I think that's right, David Leonard.
That is right. So it all depends on whether you think what should be the universe that we're looking at. The military, as I mentioned before, is roughly one quarter of the total federal budget and roughly one half of the discretionary part. I think one of the problems here is we've been trying to get all of our deficit reduction from only one half of the budget, the discretionary part. And despite that word discretionary, Congress has the discretion to pass laws that affect Medicare and Social Security. They've simply chosen not to do so.
And can I just follow up quickly with you, David Leonard, and get your take on the $110 million that's being cut from national parks? Because I know you probably saw that National Park Service Directory, Director John Jarvis, put out essentially, well, a statement that said that this is going to have tremendous impact.
Yeah, and so, you know, national parks are an example of something. You can't claim that national parks lead to a lot of economic growth in the future, but national parks are an enormous benefit to people in this country, certainly in California, where they drive a lot of your tourism, they drive a lot of in-state travel as well. And so this is an example of one of the ways in which people, I think, are tangibly going to feel the sequester, because it will have an impact on national parks, much as it does on the military and on education and on a whole lot of other realms.
Well, we'll continue, obviously, to follow this story. I want to thank all of you who called in and sent your messages by email and joined us in our website. And again, remind you that on that website, all the cuts are spelled out for you, kqed.org. Let me thank David Leonard from the New York Times and Stephen Levy from the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy and all the guests we spoke with, a number of them by phone. And thank you again, our listeners, because we wouldn't be here without you, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.